Indeed. Going along, Shockley is another contender for the Most Intriguing CIA Conspirator Award. After years of collaboration with Traficante organization Cubans, he and part of his Miami staff were transferred to Laos, where he joined Lucien Conain. They helped organize the CIA secret Mayo Tribesmen Army, the second such army drummed up by Shockley that was up to its ears in the drug traffic. Vientiane, where Shockley was the station chief, which of course is the capital of Laos, where Shockley was the station chief, became the new center of the heroin trade. Later, he ran the station in Saigon, where the traffic flowed under the profiteering administration of Premier Ngaien Cao Ky. When the agency prepared its coup against the Chilean President Salvador Allende, Shockley was its chief of covert operations in the Western Hemisphere. When William Colby became the director of the CIA in 1973, Shockley took over his job as chief of covert operations in the Far East. Eventually, he was booted out of the agency as part of the shakeup ordered by its current director, Stansfield Turner. In the JM Wave period, a great expansion in China lobby, Traficante, Cuban exile, CIA connections occurred. William Pauley, again, Pauley, financed a mysterious summer 1963 boat raid against Cuba in his own yacht, the Flying Tiger II. Besides Pauley himself, the crew included a mafioso John Martino, who had operated roulette wheels in one of Traficante's Havana casinos, CIA agents codenamed Rip, Mike, and Ken, the ubiquitous Rolando Martinez, and a dozen other Cuban exiles led by Eddie Bayo and Eduardo Perez, many of whom eventually disappeared mysteriously. Lauren Hall, L-O-R-E-N, Hall, another former Traficante casino employee, claimed that both his boss and Sam Giancana had helped plan the raid. Claire Booth Luce, a queen pin of the China lobby, and of course also the matriarch of the Luce family that brings us Time and Life and all those other great magazines. Claire Booth Luce, a queen pin of the China lobby, testified during Senate hearings on the CIA that she had financed an exile gunboat raid on Cuba after JFK had ordered the agency to halt such raids.
Okay, and remember the name Lauren Hall, too, because he's going to be cropping up in a big way as we examine how the Aryan Nations proper intersects with this paramilitary organization, this paramilitary milieu that we're looking at the development of right now. Recall that in the discussion of the origins of the World Anti-Communist League and in analyzing how the China lobby came to be focused, first of all in Guatemala and later in Cuba, Henry Kruger spoke of an interesting fact which we're going to take up in detail here, namely the fact that the president of what eventually was to be the Latin American affiliate of the World Anti-Communist League was none other than a former attorney, at that time the active attorney for New Orleans capo mafioso Carlos Marcello, also involved in the Kennedy assassination as we looked at in Guns of November number 1. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the World Anti-Communist League is something which is very much on the scene today. We're going to be talking about that in our next broadcast at great length and in a little bit in the broadcast tonight. But it's worth noting that the World Anti-Communist League was really a consolidation of pre-existing organizations. It formally came into being in late 1966, but it actually was in existence in the form of a number of pre-existing organizations before that. What happened in 66 is they became formally associated and titled, whereas previously the association had been informal and the groups did not have a unified title. But the World Anti-Communist League in particular has cropped up in connection with the discussion of Latin American death squads in a series of Jack Anderson columns, and we're going to be talking about that also in a future Radio Free America. Going back to the Marcello connection here, specifically one of his attorneys becomes president of what was to become the Latin American affiliate of WACL. Interesting discussion about that is contained in a book called Crime and Cover-Up, subtitled The CIA, the Mafia, and the Dallas Watergate Connection, that was authored by University of California at Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott, whose work we dealt with just a few minutes ago. This book was copyrighted in 1977 and published by the Westworks Publishers of Berkeley. And of the future, or the World Anti-Communist League affiliate to be of Latin America, and its development and its president, an attorney for Carlos Marcello, Scott writes as follows. The CIA had long used the Mafia's corrupt influence in Caribbean dictatorships as an asset in its own anti-communist arsenal. Thus, the chairman of a 1958 anti-communist conference in Guatemala, of a group organized for the CIA 4 years earlier by E. Howard Hunt, was Antonio Valladares, V-A-L-L-A-D-A-R-E-S, the law partner of the CIA-installed Minister of the Interior, and the attorney for New Orleans capo mafioso Carlos Marcello. Valladares once arranged for Marcello's false birth registration in Guatemala. Also present at the 1958 meeting was a New Orleans lawyer, Maurice B. Gatlin, G-A-T-L-I-N, who was also involved in other anti-communist activities at the 544 Camp Street address used by Oswald. Okay, now at this point, we're going to stop and review a little bit from our Guns of November number one about the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place dichotomy here and explain just how it is that people like this could be involved with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Indeed, and the 541, the 544 Camp Street, 531 Lafayette Place is a fascinating story, and almost in and of itself, to any rational observer, I think, is enough to just about queer the Warren Commission theory of a lone nut working by himself. We're going to read a short segment from a book called Conspiracy by Anthony Summers. It's copyright 1980 by McGraw-Hill. And it talks about such people as Guy Bannister and others and their involvement with 544 Camp Street. Guy Bannister is a detective, and it's going to talk a little bit about him, but that's the Bannister that they're referring to. Bannister's brother told the Assassinations Committee that Guy, quote, mentioned seeing Oswald hand out fair play for Cuba literature. Ivan Nitschke, a business associate of Bannister and a fellow former FBI agent, recalls that Bannister became, quote, interested in Oswald in the summer of 1963. Adrian Alba, who ran the garage next door to Oswald's place of work, testified to the committee that he often saw Oswald in the restaurant on the ground floor of 544 Camp Street. That restaurant had a rear exit leading up to the office section of the building, and Bannister was a regular patron. Mrs. Roberts firmly believes that whatever the nature of Bannister's, quote, interest in Oswald, it concerned anti-Castro schemes, plans which she feels certain had the support and encouragement of government intelligence agencies. As she put it, quote, Mr. Bannister had been a special agent for the FBI and was still working for them. There were quite a number of connections which he kept with the FBI and the CIA, too. I know he and the FBI traded information due to his former association, unquote. Now, lest this get too confusing at this point, let me just point out really quickly what exactly is going on. 544 Camp Street is the location of, among other businesses, the office of Guy Bannister's detective agency. Guy Bannister, himself a former FBI agent, as we will see, had a long relationship with this paramilitary milieu we were referring to, which has its roots back initially in the China lobby, but also came to fruition in the Guatemalan invasion of 1953 and 54, and then later in the Bay of Pigs and the Kennedy assassination.
Take very careful note here, because, again, as we're reading for 4 hours, it's really tough to note one individual fact or two. But notice that this alleged right-wing detective agency was not only, according to a number of reports, still actively used by the FBI and CIA, but that specifically this office was used by an organization called the CRC, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which is the umbrella organization for all anti-Castro CIA-sponsored groups. And this group and one of its main operatives, Sergio Arcacha Smith, who Nip will tell you about here in a second, were headquartered at Bannister's office. It's a really important thing to remember, and also, by the way, one which we did not have included in our Guns of November number one, because we're sort of learning along with everyone else, and we're constantly developing the material here.
That's right. And I should just mention also to you before I resume that we are broadcasting from Foothill College. This is KFJC Los Altos Hills. Now, the key thing to realize here as we're talking about 544 Camp Street is that on one hand you have such things as Guy Bannister's office, his connections to the Bay of Pigs people, the CRC, this Cuban anti-Castro right-wing operation that is operating through Bannister's office, people like Sergio Arcacha Smith and a man named Carlos Bringier, who later wound up having a fist fight with Lee Harvey Oswald out on a street corner and was basically the reason that Oswald came to public notice as a quote-unquote Marxist. Of course, at the time that they had this fistfight, Carlos Springer and Lee Harvey Oswald, Carlos Springer was, as mentioned, a member of the Cuban Revolutionary Council, an anti-Castro group. Lee Harvey Oswald was purportedly giving out leaflets in support of Castro in the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. As it turns out, Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans, and that, in fact, the address on the Fair Play for Cuba Committee literature was 531 Lafayette, which was, in fact, merely another entrance to 544 Camp Street.
Worth mentioning, too, that the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which was the umbrella group to sort of subsume leadership over all of the anti-Castro CIA groups, was consolidated by E. Howard Hunt and Bernard Barker, both of whom were later Watergate burglars. And as we looked at Hunt putting together the China lobbyists who overthrow Arbenz in 54, part of that same group then meets and elects Carlos Marcello's attorney as its president, and Maurice Gatlin of the 544 Camp Street complex that we're talking about is present at that meeting. So it's worth noting how these threads run through time.
Okay, continuing with Conspiracy by Anthony Summers. Bannister's former employee, Daniel Campbell, also became convinced that his boss was involved with the FBI. An FBI report of an interview with Bannister after the assassination indicates that he was asked questions about anti-Castro exiles, but none at all about Oswald or use of the 544 Camp Street address on Oswald's leaflets. As for Bannister and the CIA, an Assassinations Committee check revealed only that the agency, quote, considered using Guy Bannister Associates for the collection of foreign intelligence, unquote, but decided against it. That, however, was in 1960, 3 years before the episode of Oswald in New Orleans. Delphine Roberts says, quote, I think he received, she's talking again about Guy Bannister, I think he received funds from the CIA. I know he had access to large funds at various times in 1963, unquote. She adds that known intelligence agents and law enforcement officers frequently visited Bannister's office. 16 years ago, she accepted the comings and goings as quite normal because, so far as she was concerned, the strangers were involved with her boss in, quote, doing something to try and stop what was taking place, the danger that was facing this country because of Cuba, unquote. The anti-Castro exiles involved with Bannister make an intriguing list. There was Sergio Arcacha Smith, an extreme right-winger who had served under Castro's predecessor, the dictator Batista. In 1961, he became New Orleans representative of the Cuban Revolutionary Council and, at Bannister's instigation, set up the CRC office at 544 Camp Street. CIA records reveal that Arcacha, quote, maintained extensive relations with the FBI. Two of his regular FBI contacts were, and the names are deleted, and Guy Bannister. Significantly, Bannister, supposedly long retired, is referred to flatly as an active FBI contact. Arcacha, who said privately he was controlled by the CIA, turned 544 Camp Street, in the words of one of his acquaintances, into a sort of, quote, Cuban Grand Central Station for the exiles. When Arcacha cast around for funds, he was offered a, quote, substantial donation by none other than Carlos Marcello, the New Orleans Mafia boss. By 1963, Arcacha had moved to Texas, removed from his New Orleans CRC job after accusations of misappropriation of funds. Arcacha denies all knowledge of Oswald prior to the assassination, but one of his successors did encounter the alleged assassin. This was CRC delegate Frank Bartes, who turned up with Carlos Bringier for the court case following the street fracas. On that occasion, he indulged in a noisy argument with Oswald. Bartes said he never visited 544 Camp Street and never had anything else to do with Oswald. Arcacha and the CRC have been firmly linked to at least two other people, apart from Bannister, who did cross paths with the alleged assassin. One was Carlos Quiroga, the anti-Castro Cuban who admitted visiting Oswald at home a few days after his street confrontation with Cuban exiles. Quiroga provided some of the information which helped expose Oswald as a communist on the forthcoming radio debate.
Of course, that forthcoming radio debate is to be heard on our Guns of November number one, in which a number of interesting people, including Carlos Bringer of the CRC, are interviewed along with Lee Harvey Oswald. And the man who under whose auspices that interview was conducted, an Army intelligence agent named Ed Butler, is a person we're going to be talking about at considerable length on the broadcast this evening. So remember that particular radio debate and the people involved in it. Now, not only was the Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee chapter located at the same place as the anti-Castro CIA organization, which is improbable enough. Recall Oswald the only member of this alleged, or well, it was a real organization, its alleged New Orleans chapter. But interestingly enough, the person under whom Lee Harvey Oswald was employed in New Orleans, a man named William Riley, who had a coffee company by that name, was also employed by the CRC and one of its subsidiary organizations. This is carried in a book called, this information is carried in a book called Coincidence or Conspiracy. It was authored by Bernard Fensterwall Jr., one of the better known researchers, and this book is an excellent book on the assassinations. It's generally believed that Fensterwall is a U.S. intelligence agent. He himself was one of James Earl Ray's attorneys. So his work is excellent and important. If you ever run into him at a cocktail party, pour your own drinks. Anyway, as far as this book, though, Coincidence or Conspiracy by Bernard Fensterwald, published in softcover in 1977 by Zebra Books. And of William Riley, Oswald's employer in New Orleans, and Riley's employment by the CRC, the anti-Castro CIA-sponsored organization, Fensterwald writes as follows. William Riley, of the William Riley Coffee Company, was the man who first employed pro-Castro, unquote, Lee Harvey Oswald, when Oswald moved from Dallas to New Orleans in 1963. William Riley, it turns out, was at that time a financial supporter of the Free Cuba Committee, sometimes also referred to as the Crusade to Free Cuba Committee. The Free Cuba Committee was a militant, right-wing, anti-Castro group with solid connections to the CIA. The Free Cuba Committee was one of the anti-Castro exile groups that was merged into the Cuban Revolutionary Council, which was the large, anti-Castro organization coordinated by the CIA. Worth noting also something that is not mentioned in this particular passage, but that the Riley Coffee Company was on the opposite side of Lafayette Square from 544 Camp Street. So these two buildings are in the same place, and Oswald's employer in New Orleans works for the CIA and is right across the street from the headquarters of the local CIA anti-Castro organization, where, interestingly enough, Oswald has a return address on literature.
And, again, we covered most of these things in the Guns of November. We could go into great lengths about all of the contacts that Oswald, the supposed Marxist who despised the American government for their treatment of Castro, et cetera, had with anti-Castro Cubans, with Tsarist Russians, with Spaz Rakin, we mentioned already tonight, of the World Anti-Communist League, et cetera, et cetera. And then eventually winds up on a street corner getting into a fight with Carlos Bringer, going to court and later showing up on a radio program to proclaim his Marxism, or to help have his Marxism proclaimed on the radio, where it could be later flashed on the night of the assassination all over the country, Lee Harvey Oswald declaring that he was a Marxist.
It's worth noting that Sergio Arcacha Smith, who rented Bannister's 544 Camp Street detective service on behalf of the CRC, was one of the people that Jim Garrison attempted to have extradited to New Orleans, and that extradition request was refused by then-Governor of Texas John Connally, who went on to become Secretary of the Treasury under the Nixon administration, and who had been Secretary of the Navy and had downgraded Lee Harvey Oswald's discharge status.
Okay, going to read a short segment here about that radio show and some of the people involved in it. This is from Crime and Cover-Up, which we've read from already tonight by Peter Dale Scott. Finally, Oswald and Bringer debated together on station WDSU. And by the way, as Dave mentioned, that is, we actually aired that debate during the Guns of November. And Oswald was exposed by a third participant, Bringer's close friend Ed Butler, as a man who had, quote, turned in his passport in Moscow and, quote, applied for Soviet citizenship. Butler's cited sources were Washington newspaper stories, which he later explained he had obtained, quote, through a third party in Washington. This dramatic proof of the FPCC, Fair Play for Cuba Committee's, communist background was then recorded as a, quote, truth tape for distribution to radio stations throughout Latin America by Ed Butler's, quote, psychological warfare organization, the Information Council of the Americas, or INCA. Oswald's self-revelation as an FPCC Marxist on that tape was given by Bringier and Butler to the world on November 22, 1963, right after Oswald's arrest. And as a result, the FPCC decided to close down shortly thereafter. It is not unreasonable to suspect U.S. government sponsorship of Butler's Inca operation. On September 12, 1963, 4 days before the CIA contacted the FBI about the Fair Play for Cuba committee, Butler returned to Washington and told a House committee about his, quote, truth tapes activity through Inca, which he conceived of while serving in a special U.S. Army unit, quote, in the quiet little town of Alexandria, Virginia. At least four of the five other speakers with Butler represented groups like the Cuban Freedom Committee and Radio Free Europe, since identified as CIA fronts. One of Butler's prize speakers for his truth tapes was Fidel Castro's anti-communist sister, Juanita, who also served on Inca's advisory committee. The CIA engaged in major propaganda activities against Salvador Allende in the Chilean election of 1964, in which a prominent role was played by right-wing radio tapes featuring Juanita Castro, though it is not yet known whether or not these were Ed Butler's Inca truth tapes. Inca's links to both Oswald and the U.S. government were considerable. Inca's president was the famous Dr. Alton Oxner, a consultant to the U.S. Air Force, quote, on the medical side of subversive matters. Oxner, O-C-H-S-N-E-R, a friend of the Somozas, was later identified as, quote, the first man to uncover Oswald's pro-communist activities from unexplained, quote, first-hand impressions. Oxner also sponsored a local journal, Latin American Report, whose editor, William G. Gaudet, admitted a CIA connection and also was issued the Mexican travel permit immediately preceding Oswald's. At least three of Inca's backers and Cuban employees had previously been associated with the CIA-backed Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CRC, at 544 Camp Street. More important, the Riley family, Eustace Riley of Inca, William Riley of the CRC Crusade, were Oswald's ostensible employers in New Orleans. Another Inca charter member, William I. Monaghan, an ex-FBI agent, joined the Riley Company about the same time Oswald apparently did and soon became the chief source of information to the FBI and Secret Service about Oswald's activities with the company. Inca's and Butler's intelligence links became more apparent after 1963, when Butler added to his letterhead foreign intelligence and Psy War personnel, and himself joined such well-known CIA friends and veterans as Christopher Emmett and Edward Lansdale on the Planning Committee for the Freedom Studies Center of the American Security Council. Although the ASC was staffed largely by ex-FBI personnel, it was revealed because of Watergate that at least one of these, Lee R. Pennington of the ASC Washington Bureau, was also on a CIA monthly retainer. By 1969, Butler and other Inca personnel were actively involved in the White House counter-demonstrations to the growing anti-war movement.
Okay, so now note again that this Ed Butler, who arranges for their, basically stewards the Oswald interview, has all kinds of intelligence connections. It's worth noting, too, that the sister of William Riley, Oswald's CIA employer in New Orleans, right across Lafayette Square from 544 Camp Street, is a member of the Information Council of the Americas, Ed Butler's organization. And again, Ed Butler is going to be coming up in a very prominent way later on in the broadcast. Now, another person who connects up with this this paramilitary milieu that was staging commando raids into Cuba and all kinds of other things, all along the Gulf Coast and throughout the Sun Belt, again, because a lot of this was in California, as we're going to see, a lot of these people were organizing in California. One of the people who Garrison indicted and who critics of the researchers have maintained was in no way involved with the assassinations is a man named Clay Shaw. Now, Clay Shaw we looked at in Guns of November 1 and 4. In number 1, we looked at him in connection with the Garrison investigation. He was one of the primary defendants in New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison's investigation. We also took a look at his connections to the German rocket scientists, which comprised another element of the Kennedy conspiracy. We looked at that in Guns of November number 4. Specifically, Clay Shaw was an aide to a man named Holger Toftoy, who helped bring the German paperclip scientists, that is, the German rocket scientists under Project Paperclip, over to the United States. Now, again, recall Penn Jones, Jr., one of the top assassination researchers whose work I referred to earlier, and his privately published Forgive My Grief, Volumes 1 through 4. We're going to take a look at an interesting piece of information here in Forgive My Grief, Volume 4, and this connects Clay Shaw directly to 544 Camp Street, to David Ferry, and to David Ferry was another one of the defendants in the Garrison case, died before the case could come to trial. And we're going to take a look now at information connecting Shaw directly to the CIA and to anti-Castro efforts based around 544 Camp Street. Again, from Forgive My Grief, Volume 4, privately published by Penn Jones in 1974. Volume 4 is 74, Volume 3, 69. This is from an editorial, again, from the Midlothian Mirror, included in Penn Jones' book. It's called The Strange Death of Clay Shaw, stated September 12th, 1974. In January of this year, former CIA staff member Victor Marchetti revealed that Clay Shaw was a paid contact of the Central Intelligence Agency back in the early 1960s. Note that the surgery on Shaw, in an earlier paragraph here, he mentions that Clay Shaw had some surgery allegedly for a blood clot. Note that the surgery on Shaw occurred only a few weeks after the release of these facts. Interrupting again, Shaw supposedly died under surgery. That's highly doubtful, but the official version is that he died while in surgery. Continuing here, Marchetti stated that while Shaw was being investigated by Garrison in 1968, frequent morning briefing sessions were held with high agency officials in which serious concern was voiced concerning the possibility of the New Orleans district attorney uncovering Shaw's CIA contacts and making them public. Garrison had alleged on several occasions that Shaw was a CIA operative, but he was never able to prove his contention. These same high agency officials also often expressed the need to give help to Shaw and his defense team during Garrison's investigation. Marchetti also related that Shaw, David Ferry, E. Howard Hunt, Frank Sturgis, Bernard Barker, and others were all working together in the CIA's Bay of Pigs planning operation. This information becomes very important when one considers the fact that Garrison and other JFK assassination researchers have long contended that President Kennedy was killed with the help of CIA operatives who were infuriated over the manner in which Kennedy handled the Bay of Pigs fiasco. The above information alone is enough to mark Shaw as one of those to die under strange circumstances, unquote. But add to this the episode of how Shaw was found dead and you have a real mind-boggler. Shortly before Shaw was reported dead, a neighbor observed an ambulance pulling up in front of the Shaw home. Then, two ambulance attendants carried a stretcher with a figure on it covered by a sheet into the house. The two men then quickly left with an empty stretcher, and a few hours later Shaw was reported found dead in his home alone, unquote. Recall that an earlier report mentioned that he died from during surgery. The body was immediately taken to a local mortuary and embalmed before parish coroner Dr. Frank Minyard was notified of the death. Later, Dr. Minyard issued a press statement in which he condemned the speedy embalming of Shaw's body and stated the action rendered impossible the determination of cause of death. So according to Victor Marchetti, a published author on the subject of the CIA and himself a former CIA staffer, Clay Shaw was very much a part of the 544 Camp Street Bay of Pigs milieu, which included David Ferry, Carlos Bringier, and Sergio Arcacha Smith, and so forth. And very important because the Ferry-Shaw link had been established before, and there were a number of other links between Shaw and Oswald, but this particular piece of testimony, or this statement by Victor Marchetti, is the most direct connecting link between all these principal defendants in the Garrison case.
We also know, of course, that Ferry himself, David Ferry, who we're going to hear a little bit more about right now, was involved in training pilots for the 1953 invasion in Guatemala to topple the Arbenz regime. David Ferry, for reasons one people are not quite sure about, his library card turned up in Lee Harvey Oswald's wallet, although David Ferry maintained long after the assassination that he had, in fact, no knowledge of Lee Harvey Oswald and that the two did not know each other. This does not explain how Lee Harvey Oswald found David Ferry's library card, and interestingly enough, it does not explain away the obvious connections that Lee Harvey Oswald and David Ferry had, which we're going to hear a little bit about. This is from Anthony Summers' book, Conspiracy, and it goes as follows. After the assassination, there was perfunctory inquiry into Oswald's membership as a youth of nearly 16 of the Civil Air Patrol. Oswald was then living with his mother in New Orleans and joined the patrol as a cadet in 1955. David Ferry, an airman of skill and renown, was at that time a leading light of the local patrol unit. after the assassination, one of Bannister's employees said he thought he recalled seeing a photograph of Oswald, along with other one-time CAP members, in Ferry's home. Ferry was asked about this on a couple of occasions and claimed he could remember nothing about Oswald. He denied ever having had any sort of relationship with Oswald. Since he also denied knowing that the Cuban Revolutionary Council and its representative Arcacha ever operated from Camp Street, a fact he certainly did know about, Ferry's denial should have raised suspicions. The FBI, however, conducted a mockery of an inquiry into Oswald's membership in the Civil Air Patrol, and the matter was dropped. There was no further action when one of Oswald's former schoolmates, Edward Vobel, first stated that he and Oswald had been in the patrol, quote, with Captain Dave Ferry. And then, quite suddenly, he, quote, could not recall the matter. The FBI was unmoved by the fact that Vobel had been scared by a crank-type telephone call and a visit to his home by a strange man. Nor was the Bureau stung into action when another former cadet said Ferry had scurried around to see him after the assassination, asking whether any old group photographs of Ferry's squadron featured Oswald. Most of the squadron records, it turned out, had been, quote, stolen in late 1960. Even in 1978, Congress's Assassinations Committee did better, meaning better than the Warren Commission. Investigators established that Ferry's service with the Air Patrol fitted in with that of Oswald. They also identified no fewer than six witnesses whose statements tended to confirm that Oswald had been present at patrol meetings attended by Ferry. One said flatly, quote, Oswald and Ferry were in the unit together. I'm not saying that they may have been there together, I'm saying it's a certainty. Nobody at this date can recall any special relationship between the bizarre instructor and the cadet who would one day become infamous. The Assassinations Committee noted, however, that Ferry's, quote, appeal to several young men may have been related to his taking an extraordinary interest in them. He often gave parties at his residence where liquor flowed freely, and he offered his home as a place for the boys to stay when they were unhappy at home. Oswald, as we now know, had a miserable home life. His school friend, Edward Vobel, believed Oswald attended a party given by Ferry after one patrol qualification ceremony. Ferry's homosexuality, and his weakness for young boys in particular, is a matter of record. Over the years, it led him repeatedly into trouble and sometimes into police custody. On one occasion, he was freed only after the intervention of a familiar figure, Cuban exile leader Sergio Arcacha Smith. Similarly, in the mid-50s, Ferry's misconduct with youths in the Air Patrol led to scandal. There were reports of drunken orgies, of boys capering about in the nude, and in the end it was this that ended Ferry's tenure with the New Orleans unit. There is not yet any evidence that Oswald was involved in such goings-on, but, at the age of 16 and on the threshold of an adult sexual life, he was certainly vulnerable to the likes of Ferry. The Assassinations Committee noted that, homosexuality aside, Ferry exerted, quote, tremendous influence through his close association with his pupils in the patrol. A committee analysis adds that he, quote, urged several boys to join the armed forces. Many of Ferry's cadets became involved in Ferry's wide spectrum of other activities, unquote. And remember, part of the wide spectrum of Ferry's other activities was working with people like Clay Shaw and E. Howard Hunt on the Guatemala invasion and the Bay of Pigs.
Also recall that Sergio Arcacha Smith, one of the people Garrison tried to have extradited to New Orleans, had gotten him off of an earlier Marles bust. Now remember the Oswald Ferry Association in the Civil Air Patrol, and remember also this the thesis that we're developing, which basically is that the Aryan Nations is part of an underground extension of the military, and we're going to take a look at that now. The whole Civil Air Patrol connection appears very intriguing, and again appears to involve, certainly compel the notion that This group, which was to be involved in the assassination of President Kennedy, certainly had very strong connections to the military and may have been an extension of it. Going back again to Forgive My Grief, Volume 4, published by Penn Jones, Jr. In an article here from June 25, 1970, called the CAP, the Civil Air Patrol, and the TSBDB, the Texas School Book Depository. We quote below an interesting letter printed in the Dallas Times-Herald of Sunday, June 14, 1970, support for Nixon. President Nixon and our military leaders need the support of all Americans for their courage in hitting communist strongholds supplying Viet Cong troops from the sanctuaries of neutral Cambodia. I have thanked the president for his courageous stand and told him of support from the Civil Air Patrol throughout our nation. It was my good fortune to have been one of the co-founders of Civil Air Patrol 6 days before another enemy in another time staged a sneak attack on our forces deployed at Pearl Harbor. Interrupting here, recall Louis Siefkin, the German intelligence agent who had a lot to do with that, became under Wiedemeyer, Chiang Kai-shek's head of intelligence. Just an aside here. Continuing, in years of peace and war since that time, the Civil Air Patrol has drawn its membership from the mainstream of America. I feel the support of this volunteer group to anti-communist policies of our government should be made known. The President should hear from more individuals and groups who want peace with honor to offset the loud demonstrations of those who would settle for peace at any price. He has sent a reply that shows his deep concern. He, too, is a man of peace. Brigadier General D. Harold Byrd, BYRD, Civil Air Patrol, Dallas. And then Penn Jones goes on to comment about that letter. Interesting speculation here is whether or not General Byrd ever knew Captain David Ferry of the Civil Air Patrol Unit of New Orleans. Pictured here, and on the following page they have a picture, pictured here is a photograph of Lee Harvey Oswald while he was a recruit in Captain Ferry's Civil Air Patrol Unit in New Orleans. Picture is from the book Red Roses from Texas by Naren E. Gun, G-U-N, which was published in England in 1964. One of the reasons Gun's book is so scarce is that it shows Oswald in the uniform furnished by Commander Ferry. No one that we know of has ever questioned General Byrd as to whether or not he ever knew Lee Oswald or Captain Ferry. Another strange happenstance is that General D. Harold Byrd owned the Texas School Book Depository building at the time of the assassination. Also very strange is that General Byrd recently sold the building at an auction and took $650,000 for the building. The building was worth more money than that, and in fact, General Byrd had let it be known that he expected to get $1,500,000 for the building. So, interesting that that the head of the Civil Air Patrol should own the Texas School Book Depository and that we have the Oswald Ferry Association in the Civil Air Patrol. And with regard to all of these people who we find cropping up in connection with Oswald's background, well, one thing that we should probably interject at this point, and obviously we covered it at great length in Guns of November, Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill President Kennedy or in anyone else. The important thing in examining the people around Oswald and the people who handle him is to look at the people who were creating the myth which has survived to this day, the myth, Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone assassin, because he's a very important person to study even though he did not pull the trigger, because it's the people around him and the circumstances around him that tell us who created the myth.
Indeed, all you have to do, once again, is look at these various people involved in shepherding Oswald from one place to the other. The CIA Bay of Pigs Guatemala pilot David Ferry, who was one of his earliest mentors in the Civil Air Patrol, the Brigadier General Byrd in charge of the Civil Air Patrol, who owned the Texas School Book Depository from where the shots ostensibly came, or at least from where Oswald was employed and was set up to take the fall for the murder of John F. Kennedy. Clay Shaw and Sergio Arcachas Smith and Guy Bannister, all of them involved with David Ferry and involved with E. Howard Hunt and the Bay of Pigs people, all of them conveniently also involved with 544 Camp Street in New Orleans, which was the site of Oswald's supposed pro-Marxist Fair Play for Cuba committee that got him branded as a Marxist. Ed Butler, the CIA contact with his various intelligence and right-wing connections, who was the one who made Oswald's Marxism known publicly. All you have to do is look at the links, and then look at the links between all of these people and the injection of the military through groups like the John Birch Society and the Information Council of the Americas and these related groups. The injection of the military into American political life and into civilian society, and you begin to see the lineaments of the conspiracy, and there's no other word for it, that we have been talking about, come shouldering up and in all their ugliness into the broad daylight of democracy, to weave a very tangled metaphor. Anyway, while you're thinking about that particular last...
It's appropriate to weave a tangled metaphor for a tangled thing like that. I mean, if you look at the intersections of Inca with the 544 Camp Street and CRC and Oswald, it tangled. I don't think you could come up with a metaphor that wouldn't be tangled.
That's right. As a matter of fact, it was good old William Shakespeare who said, "Ah, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive." And deception and treachery is indeed what we're talking about here.
And in fact, we're going to read from an essay called The Tangled Web later in the broadcast.
All right. And later in the broadcast is where we are going to be for a moment, because we're going to take a short break for about 5 minutes, and then we will be back to get into more of this information. And of course, Radio Free America is a sort of a two-pronged title for this broadcast, This is Nip Tuck in the studios with Dave Emery. And on one hand, of course, there's the obvious satire on Radio Free Europe and the various other radio stations set up and funded by the CIA and run by mostly European anti-communists, a euphemistic word quite often, but not always, of course, for European fascists of various stripes. So there's the obvious pun on that, but Radio Free America is also what we're getting to be closer and closer to, if by radio we're referring to the value that radio has as a medium to transmit useful information, and if the Reagan administration control of the FCC and the gradual clampdown on freedom of expression is allowed to run its course, a Radio Free America is in fact what we could be looking at in the next few years. So remember, those of you out there, while you're sitting there listening to this kind of broadcast and shaking your heads and saying, oh gosh, it's so terrible what they say, it's right. You know, they're right, but it's just so awful. It requires a little bit more action on your parts than just to sit and shake your heads. Dave and I have obviously made our decision to use the input that we have into the media to get this information out to people, but it's your responsibility, A, to pass the information on to other people, and B, to try and do something with it, at the very least by being informed yourself. Using that information to help your judgments be better about the kind of world that you want to live in. So remember, if you don't want to live in the kind of place where Radio Free America is no longer a clever title, then pay attention, and hopefully we can all do something about these things.
A short way of saying it is, you wouldn't want to live in Nazi Germany, would you? Well, you're going to be if you don't wake up. And this, I guess you could look at these programs as sort of an anti-fascist alarm clock for the public.
Right. And the scary thing is that these people learn their lessons, and you probably won't realize it if you don't watch closely, because everybody's going to be spending more and more time plugged into the cable watching pay-per-view boxing from the Mafia Hub in Las Vegas and 24-hour-a-day mind cartoons on MTV and, you know, just kind of basically doing your Silicon Valley computer work that three times removed goes straight to the Defense Department so you can afford to buy your toot and spend the weekend watching X-rated porn videos or whatever the case may be. And you may not notice the fact that the country is turning Nazi around you. But believe us, folks, as we talked about the other day, the highest law enforcement officer of the country, Ed Meese, which in and of itself is terrifying, is talking about how there's no need for Miranda rights because if the police arrest you, you might be guilty. And Ronald Reagan is handing out John Birch Society propaganda on Ted Koppel's Nightline. And folks, it's no joke. The future is now. And it's also a year past 1984. So anyway, think about it. We're going to go on with our material here, and I'm going to let Dave introduce this next sort of longish section and explain how this ties in with some of the other stuff we've been talking about.
Now, a major aspect of Kennedy's policy, which we just have not had an opportunity in past broadcasts to do justice to, concerns his Cuban policy. There are massive indications, and we're about to present those right now, that President Kennedy was moving at the time of his assassination to do something which no president since Kennedy has done, namely to normalize diplomatic relations with Cuba. The United States does not have diplomatic relations with Cuba to this day. Kennedy was moving to establish those relations, and there is considerable indication, obviously, in light of the massive underground military force. In fact, it wasn't really underground. It was explicitly sanctioned by the National Security Establishment and set up all around the Gulf states and, as we'll see, in California. This paramilitary milieu, this underground army, this sort of ad hoc civilian army which was put together in order to fight Fidel Castro was poised and ready, and we've seen the ideological orientation of a lot of the people involved, and we've looked at the China lobby in the past in our Aryan Nations broadcasts and how the Cuba lobby and the Guatemala lobby, I guess you could say, grew out. The Guatemalan group grew out of the China lobby. And obviously, people like that were in no way inclined to restore diplomatic relations with Castro.